about like 2 seconds for it right now, actually. But no one actually like one person might stumble upon this, I think, and that'd be amazeballs if that happened.
Okay.
But
you're not like actively like broadcasting this.
No, I'm not actively getting people to look at how awesome you are, which I should. I probably do that, but no. Yeah, I just, it's more like archive type of thing, and so.
But, no, yeah. That's fantastic. Good.
Yeah. Cool. I was looking through our archive. I was just like, I know we had Brad on before. When was the last time we had Brad on? It was like April 19th, 2012.
It was. Yeah, I remember. I was in a little conference room in New York City, like because I was still working at my old job and everything. So it was that was a long time ago. ages and ages ago. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. But yeah, it's great. Cool. So I guess we should get started then. Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt. On today's show, we talk modular web design with Brad Frost, the web designer who created the mental model of atomic design. He's a sought-after designer, speaker, and consultant about responsive web design. His new book, entitled Atomic Design, explains the concept of modular design as well as positioning it in the workflow for multi-device web developers. The book is out now in print and ebook versions at atomicdesign.bradfrost.com. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, TELEJECT, where I try to be witty in spite of my many, many typos. CSS DevConf 2017 is in New Orleans this October. Early bird tickets are on sale, or at least they should be, at cssdevconf.com. The Virtual Scalable Vector Graphics SVG conference is taking place on February 15th with Chris Coyer, Sarah Drasner, Amelia Bellamy-Rhodes, and many more experts. You can take 20% off registration with the code NonBreakingSpaceShow when you register now at svgsummit.com. Again, that's svgsummit.com. Also, set it, forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, you'll be notified in your inbox by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. As always, you can find the show notes and links discussed in today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. If you like the show, please tell others about Non-Breaking Space and where to find it on iTunes. Now, on with the show. You've been on our show before, and but I wanted to bring you back on because it's always after writing several books about web design myself, I always like it to bring people on who've written a new book to help promote it. It's the Atomic Design book, which is an awesome cover and really minimalist. I love it. So I know you have a whole book about it, you have multiple pages about it, but can you summarize what the book is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, Atomic Design is sort of a mental model about thinking about our user interfaces as a hierarchy that allows us to sort of create better design systems to better serve our user interfaces. So and the book sort of introduces that methodology, but it also talks about sort of why design systems and pattern libraries and style guides are so important now. And then it goes through sort of pattern library and style guide sort of tools and what goes into a successful pattern library. And then it goes into basically everything that goes into making and maintaining a successful design system. So it's definitely been sort of a hot topic over the last couple of years. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of traction, just the concepts of modular design. So it was really a lot of fun to sort of explore that in detail.
And is that why we need it? Like, is why Atomic Design is needed? Because modular designs, why is that important?
Yeah. So to sort of back up, I guess, to without getting too far into what atomic design is, atomic design is basically sort of five distinct stages of thinking about a UI that all sort of happen concurrently. But it's like you could sort of break down a UI into these sort of five distinct stages as I sort of define them. And so it's atoms, molecules, organisms, templates, and pages. And, you know, organisms are more complex than molecules, which are more complex than atoms and stuff like that. And why that matters, or sort of what led me to sort of start thinking in this way, is that I saw that, you know, people were starting to think about things more in terms of patterns and stuff, and that's fantastic. And some of the first pattern libraries that started getting released, as well as sort of the growth of tools like Bootstrap and Foundation and stuff like that, they, you know, classify things as modules. So, you know, everything's modules and patterns and stuff, and that's great. But as I saw more and more of these things sort of get rolled out, I was like, man, it's great to think of modules, but it's essentially we're going from modules to completed pages. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you know, I get that, but at the same time, like, is that, you know, can we maybe take that further? Is there a way to be more deliberate with it rather than it's like, cool, here's just a bunch of patterns, and then we just sort of somehow magically turn them into our final pages. So that's what sort of led me to say, okay, you know, maybe we could think about this as sort of more, you know, sort of concrete steps, or sort of break this down a little further. And so that's I think what's served me very well is basically thinking about things in a little more of a nuanced way than I guess existed before atomic design.
Right. Yeah. I think everyone understands, like, and this could be like a little basic way of thinking about things, but you know, you have your source-side includes, or your includes, or you bring those in, and then you also have all on the extreme, like Bootstrap, which is like, here's a whole system if you want it, you know, just, you know, start marking it up and use a style. But to actually have that granular, like modular approach that you say, probably like the granular approach is like the atomic structures, where you're like, oh, here's this small atom of markup, and then you build on top of that, I think, and using that as a system rather than, you know, chunks of a page or system, that's a pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's, you know, sort of these very varied levels of complexity is sort of I'd say, like, one of the things that I think is sort of unique to atomic design is sort of making delineating between sort of relatively simple components and relatively complex components. So I call relatively simple components molecules, right? Where basically if you were to explode, say, a little sort of form field cluster, so that might be comprised of like a label, an input, and maybe a note about that input, for instance, you know, like some instructions, or like, here's what this field is for, or something. That's a sort of like a relatively simple component. If you were to blow that thing up, you'd be left with sort of a handful of HTML tags, essentially. Mm-hmm. But then that field, of course, gets included into more complex structures, what I call organisms, and that might be a whole contact form, for instance, right? So you have several instances of that same field component, that field molecule, you know, a few different times, right? Name, email, and so on, stuff like that. So that's where this sort of idea of thinking of things as a hierarchy, as sort of, I think of it as like Russian nesting dolls, right? Where like the sort of more simple things are included in the more complex things, which are included in the even more complex things, which are included in, you know, until you get a sort of a finalized web page. But you're able to sort of, depending on your needs, like if you're designing or developing this thing, you know, you're able to sort of home in on the area you need to, you know. So sometimes, like, as actually just today for a client project, I'm working on a footer. So I'm just homed right in on the footer. I don't necessarily need to show it in the context of the homepage or whatever, but I'm just able to work on that sort of component in isolation. But then, of course, I also want to make sure that it jives well with, you know, with the rest of the page. So I, with atomic design, I'm able to sort of simultaneously isolate it into its own little sort of chunk, but then I'm also able to sort of, you know, include that in all of my different pages and make sure that it looks all right.
You also introduce Pattern Lab, which I know if we'll put in the show notes, but we've had Dave Olson talk about the Pattern Lab 2 that came out. Would you say Pattern Lab is like the heart and soul of, and I'm totally like softballing that question for you, but how would you describe Pattern Lab then? And we just like, yeah, in terms of, as it relates to atomic design.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough to describe, actually. I still, you know, after all these years, I actually still find it hard to describe, but basically Pattern Lab is, you know, so atomic design is a mental model, essentially. It's just a way of thinking about a UI. And Pattern Lab is a tool to bring that sort of mental model to life that allows me to, and now others, I guess, it allows me to work in this way, to include atoms into molecules, into organisms, into templates, and into pages and stuff. So, it's a bit of a pattern library tool or style guide tool, but I don't think, I think that sort of sells it short, and that's not actually what it does. It's actually where I do all of my development, essentially. Like all of my front end development gets done in Pattern Lab until it comes time to like integrate it with a back end or something. So Pattern Lab is Brian Munzenmeyer that runs the Node version of it. He's sort of does a good job, and Dave also is sort of describing it as like a bit of like a laboratory, sort of like a front end, like sort of pattern based like laboratory. It's like a workspace that allows you to create these patterns, swap out data without having to spin up like, you know, a lamp stack or whatever. It's sort of like a lighter weight sort of, you know, way to sort of include patterns within each other, and also sort of swap out like lorem ipsum text with like sort of some representative text.
Yeah, and so with Pattern Lab though, like it's not it's like a starter kit, right? Is one way to think about it. Would that be true? Or like you actually have to bring your own CSS rules to it. It's not like a bootstrap where you download it and you're like, oh wait, here's all the stuff ready to go. It's actually just empty, and I think you make that point in the book. Is it's like when you took a screenshot of the opening screen, it's like, yeah, don't worry if it looks too plain,
right?
That's the idea, right? That's
right.
You have to come in with your own brand and your own vision of what you need.
Right, exactly. It's not like a competitor to Bootstrap or Foundation, or it's not sort of providing any answers as far as how you should write your CSS or markup or JavaScript or anything like that. It's totally agnostic and it's left up to you. It's essentially the workspace. Essentially, it's there to just sort of help stitch everything together. What you're actually designing and developing is still totally up to you. And in fact, we actually created a couple sort of starter kits that included things like Bootstrap and Foundation and stuff. So it's like Pattern Lab sort of the shell, and then you could put whatever you want inside of that shell, essentially.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, and then you know, and that goes with and doing this is kind of smart, because like you, especially as a freelancer or an agency developing the app or product, is just that I'll go back to Dave Roberts' statement, and you mentioned in the book as well. It's like we need to start making tiny bootstraps for every client instead of just, you know, a site or a static site or whatever like that. So,
yeah. Yeah. So with Pattern Lab, what I'll often do is sort of on my end, you know, there's typically a handful of components that I know I'm going to use and reach for sort of irrespective of whatever sort of client project I'm working on, probably going to have some sort of, you know, form stuff, a couple image sizes that sort of a card pattern or something like that. And even if it's placeholder and I'm going to like totally radically modify the markup and the look and feel of it, it's like I at least sort of have that stubbed out right there in Pattern Lab at the very beginning of a project. So I'm able to sort of quickly, reach for those and build things very quickly. I mean, and clients absolutely love, you know, going, oh, I think that we should have this sort of Pinterest style grid or whatever. And then I'm like, you mean like this? And then they're like, whoa, what'd you do? It's magic. Yeah. So that stuff is, that's obviously a testament to like just pattern based design and development or whatever. But with a tool like Pattern Lab, where you're able to sort of have, you know, your sort of custom setup, you know, and sort of have that stuff ready to go on deck, that's obviously, you know, a big saving as far as sort of development time and stuff goes. As much as I love marking up card components from scratch, like every time, some people get a lot of joy out of that, and like I get it, and I'm sort of like that, and you know, there's nothing more satisfying than just like writing like an open HTML tag or something. It's like, oh yeah, like I could handcraft this website. But you know, once you create your umpteenth card, you're like, okay, like maybe I don't need to reinvent the wheel this time.
Yeah, exactly. I understand that. Yeah, because especially if you're on the same project over and over again, you don't want to go. And that's one of the things that you also mentioned, like, is you get that human error. I don't think you mentioned it as a human error per se, but like you do UI asset collection or audit, a UI audit, I think that's what you call it. And then you actually like you go to a website and you actually, here's all your search form buttons and this is what they all look like. And they don't look the same at all. They look totally different from section to section and so that. And I think that's like super telling in terms of how, you know, consistency is needed or is actually missing from a lot of sites.
Yeah. And like that word, like human error is spot on, just because as you traverse around a website and you see, you know, seven instances, forms are, I think, maybe one of the best examples of that, just because there's validation, there's accessibility issues, there's all sorts of different considerations from both a you know, technical and sort of UX standpoint. And if you can get those things right and codify them as patterns and then just reuse those patterns, you get that stuff for free, right? You reduce that, you know, oh, if you have 17 forms, you don't have to make sure that you're worrying about that those same issues across 17, you know, different forms. You sort of take care of it at the pattern level, and then anywhere those patterns are utilized, you get those gains for free. So that's huge. And that, especially in like large enterprises and, you know, people, organizations where like compliance and stuff like that really matters, that makes it a really easy sell about like why this stuff matters so much.
Yeah. And then, one thing I do want to talk to you about, and that I found very interesting, just from what I've seen, like we do conferences, a lot of them actually per year, is that, and we usually get this kind of pinpoint problem, is that people will say like, I love this XYZ, but it's going to be hard to convince my boss or get it adopted or whatever. But one of the things you have in your chapter, you don't call it people, I forget what the name of the chapter is, but it's about dealing with people. And it's mostly like how to get people to adopt a Pattern Lab and the Atomic Design mental model. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on why that chapter is important.
And that's sort of something, I mean, I'm technically, you know, a big part of my job is sort of consulting with companies and going in and giving workshops and stuff like that. And just being at conferences and stuff as well. You hear that over and over and over again. It's like, love everything you said, but and it's, you know, I think that's great. You know, it's at least like a step in the right direction. That's better than you're full of crap. but it does. And this goes with anything. I mean, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be involved in, you know, sort of responsive design stuff for a long, long time as well. And I know that, you know, you've obviously been very involved in like the web standards movement and stuff like that. So you've seen history repeat itself just a number of times where it's like, here's clearly a better way of doing things or what's like the sort of right way of doing things. But obviously whenever it's different than the thing that, you know, people are used to, you're going to run into conflict. That's just inevitable, right? So it really becomes a matter of sort of how you sell it, approach it, what you talk about, what you don't talk about. And I think that's one of the things whenever people say, yeah, but people aren't going to get on board with this, or yeah, but I can't convince these people. Very often, I think that they assume that they have to go to their boss and say, hey, for this project, I would like to do X, and do I have permission to do this? By the way, this is going to involve, you know, changing things up a bit, you know, rocking the boat a little bit. You know, this sort of breaks our existing sort of workflow or whatever. And I think that that's, if you give people the opportunity to say no to something, they're going to say no. or they can, you know, like you have to be really compelling in your arguments in order to get them to go, oh, you know what, like that sounds, you know, it sounds like it makes sense. And, you know, we'll assume a little bit of risk to make this happen. But like, for something as simple as sort of treating our user interfaces in sort of a more modular fashion, like we already do that, especially developers. Back to like what you were saying earlier about like sort of server side includes or whatever. It's like, you know, these are not new concepts. Right. So it's just about being a little bit more deliberate with how we treat that includes folder, how we treat these patterns and stuff. It's just about sort of bringing those concepts to the forefront a little bit more, and paying attention to, oh, I'm using this card again over here. And so rather than marking up that card again, you know, by hand, you know, I'll create a component, a reusable thing, and then include that thing. And that's really all that goes into it. And your clients, your bosses, your sort of colleagues, your like non sort of designer and developer colleagues, like they don't really care about that. They care about the outcomes of that. You know, we're trying to get this page template done in a week, you know? And so that's, you know, if that's what they're thinking about, or like, how much money is this costing me? Are we going to launch on time? Stuff like that. Those are the things that they're worried about. So you don't necessarily need explicit permission in order for you to sort of approach your work in this way. You just get to say sort of, oh, by the way we got this project done on time and on budget is because we thought about things in this way. So it's more, if you set it up as like this, please boss, let me do this thing that is clearly right and will help save us a lot of time, you're introducing the chance for them to swat it down. And largely they're, you know, they're uneducated on, you know, on sort of a lot of these concepts. So it really becomes your job, you in the sort of broad sense of like, if you're working on a team, to sort of do what's right, irrespective of whether or not you have expressed permission to do so or not. And the same goes for performance, accessibility, responsiveness, stuff like that. It's, you know, do your job, do your craft's best practices to the best of your ability. And some things, yeah, will require, you know, you sort of sticking your neck out a little bit, and you have to be willing to sort of know which fights to fight. But when it comes to modular design and thinking about things like, you know, atomic design and stuff like that, it's something that we're already doing. We're just sort of trying to be more deliberate with it. Right. So that feels like, I feel like we're in better shape to adopt atomic design or sort of, you know, similar sort of mental model than we are to say responsive design that obviously involves like very visible, you know, results on the front end where it's like, whoa, this, if I'm at, you know, 960 pixels, like it looks okay. And then like whenever I squish it a little bit, it like sort of freaks out. So that's obviously a tougher, or I should say was, by now it's, you know, it's pretty well adopted, which is right. Fantastic. But like that was a tougher battle to fight.
Right.
Whereas sort of like atomic design and design systems are like, we're already doing it. We're just being more aware of it, more deliberate with it.
Right. I think also you also have your, as your, almost as a mantra, like you don't even like, you don't, in the book, you don't even sugarcoat it. You just like, ask for forgiveness. Don't ask for permission. Yeah. Like you're just like, yeah. Which is pretty cool. Almost badass, if I would say, in a way, in a whip book.
I've never come across someone that has gotten fired for for doing their crafts best practices. I've seen people get into hot water by making a big stink about it, you know, right. Again, which is why it's sort of better to fly under the radar and just do it. Rather than, you know, stomp your feet and, you know, be all negative about it. So there's like a fine line there, but yeah, but 9 times out of 10, if you were to come back and go like, oh, by the way, like this is, you know, totally accessible and, you know, inflexible and performant and in modular, sort of after the fact, no boss is going to go, whoa. Hang on a second. I didn't tell you to do that. Get out of the
right. Yeah. And then also, I feel like people, would you say like they don't need to go vertical to get approval? They can also just go sideways and I guess play a little bit of politics, but it doesn't seem like that much of politics. If you talk to your colleagues about work and say like, hey, what if we, you know, if we take a look at this pattern lab and this, you know, atomic design and see how that goes and get their buy-in.
Yeah.
And that way you can, you know, then you have like, you know, then you have a team and an army to go vertical. And
yeah. Yeah, it's definitely helpful. Just with the concept, I have a whole section in chapter 4 about sort of like pitching patterns and selling it, and I talk about what happens whenever people go, yeah, that all sounds great, but time, money, you know, whatever, like any other excuse. Right. Having like that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that's a hard stop. You can't continue to think about things in this way. It's just a matter of like, it sort of has to go a little more covert. But yeah, the more you can get your colleagues jazzed up about it and on your side and sort of, you know, get them to go, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense. Whenever it comes time to like, let's say you launch a project and then again, you sort of go, oh, by the way, you know, this is, we did this in a more modular way and this really worked for a lot of people and you can have other people back you up in that. Like that's huge as far as getting that sort of grassroots support and then eventually making it an official, sort of initiative.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Thanks too. Yeah. But yeah, you're the first book I've read. I mean, I read everyone's book about talk design, but, I read yours, but, about over 8 other web. Well, the point I'm trying to make is like, you're the first book I read that like actually goes out and talks about selling the concept and making sure people have that. And is that do you think that's just a result of you going around to a lot of conferences and finding people who do ask, you know, oh, like, but my boss won't approve it? Or is that just something that you naturally think there is that happen a lot?
Yeah, I'd say that it harkens back to those sort of early days of responsive design where we would just sort of, you know, I come from the agency world and there's at the beginning of any project, there's typically a lot of just inane, overly sort of it's like this big fireworks display of like trying to sell the clients on, you know, the moon and the stars and everything in between and stuff. Whereas I'm more of a sort of pragmatic sort of person, I guess. So rather than putting together some, you know, really expensive deck, slide deck with a bunch of sort of mock-ups and sort of things like that, what I would do in the early days of responsive design is just, one of the projects I did was Tiffany and Company. So, you know, the jewelry company, and they had, you know, their existing desktop site. And so what I did is I spent sort of a half a day taking one of their product detail pages for like a ring or something and making that responsive. And then we went into their office with a duffel bag full of devices. And then we had 2 tabs open. We just like laid them out on the conference room table. And, you know, we had their existing sort of desktop site in one tab and then my little sort of prototype in the other tab. And we had all their, you know, C-level people in there and their vice presidents and stuff. And we were just like, okay, like, here's what this responsive design thing is. So I, you know, squish it on the browser. But then I'm like, you know, knock yourself out. And so they all, you know, picked it up and were able to sort of see it's night and day. Yeah. You know, that whole, you know, the difference between a responsive experience and a desktop only one. So that's what sort of that whole notion of getting approval by way of conversion rather than sort of a bunch of long-winded sort of convincing and words and stuff like that has always been sort of at the heart of sort of how I go about things. Just because, again, you can talk people's ears off about this stuff, and you know, nine times out of ten, but a lot of times you'll get pushback because it's like, well, it's just your opinion or whatever. And so having things like data, having things like, you know, quantifiable sort of, you know, benefits of doing something one way over another has always been sort of like baked in there. And of course, that's what allows you to do the good work in the first place. At the very beginning of a project, you know, that sets the stage for everything. And I've been on more than enough projects that I'd care to admit where the stage wasn't set properly and the project crashed and burned. Yeah. You know, so I think that it's a little bit of like, it's a little, why I approach things in that way is because I've been burned so many times of like, please, for the love of God, do not just sort of come in and sort of, yeah, like set yourself up for failure or whatever, because you're just going to burn yourself out and be really disappointed and want to quit your job and stuff like that. And that shouldn't be anybody's mentality. So,
no. But yeah, I think I remember Capital Bank, you know, they went to Artifact Conference, which is, you know, and they told their story. It was like a testimonial in a way of how they had to, they didn't actually talk to their bosses at all. They just actually just made their site responsive. I guess kind of like retroactively, and so like if you had a desktop browser, it would still get serve up the old site, but then they kind of tinkered it behind the scenes, and they just adjusted it so like if you came up with some sort of multi mobile device, it would actually like be responsive.
Yeah.
And then they went to their boss like, this is what we did, and then I still remember their vision. I don't know if I forget the story was, but it was like the visual I have in my brain is that. There are programmers and they're engineers, right? And they're like developers, and they're in a meeting with other people in suits and ties, and they're just asking like, "How did our click throughs, our success, our conversions skyrocket so much in the last quarter?" They're like, and they're like, "Okay, well, this is because of responsive web design."
Yep. And
people were
hard to argue with that.
It's yeah,
real hard yeah. to argue with that.
Yeah, at that point, you have buy-in from your boss. At that point.
Yeah.
If you're in a room full of suits and they're asking like, why? How'd you do that?
It has a name.
So I did want to, like, this is kind of just a minor question I have reading your book. And this is mostly from me being a print designer coming into a web back in the day. You discussed like the page metaphor is a bad concept and that we still have pages. And in fact, the on the top of the totem pole of atomic design, if I can mix my metaphors, is the page concept. And so, I mean, you say like we should step away from that, but then at the same time, you embrace it as well. Is that what do you think of the page as this thing that we call? You
know, yeah. Like, yeah. No, it's really interesting. And it is an interesting point that I'm sort of contradictory almost with it, where it's where on one hand, sort of in chapter one, I basically say, you know, the page has been with us for a long time and it served the web really well in the early days because we, you know, we're coming from somewhere. And, you know, since you're a print designer, it's like, I'm making things for print. And now here's this new web thing. Well, how do I make things for this new medium? And it's, you know, to be able to apply similar concepts in a new medium that you're used to already is super helpful to get people on board and excited and sort of actually working and making things and stuff for the web. So it did. I think it served its purpose. The problem though is I think, you know, the word brochureware comes to mind, right? Wherever a lot of people are going, oh, okay, well, essentially we're just making PDFs and we're putting them on the web or whatever. And that really does sell the web as a medium short as far as like what it's actually able to do. And so, but then the other issues come to mind, and this is something that I've lived through, especially in my agency days, is people mapping out sort of a scope of work for a project, and the project manager is going through and saying, okay, well, you know, we have 30 pages to build. Brad, how long does one page take to make? And, you know, we'll multiply that by 30. And it's like, well, it sort of doesn't work that way because, you know, once you have a header, once you have a footer, once you have that card pattern, once you have that whatever, you know, the sort of level of effort to create each subsequent page becomes less and less and less. So in that respect, like from a process standpoint, the page doesn't really serve us anymore. On the other hand, just because, you know, whenever I started thinking about atomic design and I'm using these sort of chemistry heavy sort of words like atoms, molecules, organisms, and tons of people have written me to say, like, why not call them, you know, why not call templates and pages like ecosystems and, you know, all of these other things and or proteins and then ecosystems and stuff. And it's like, because as I learned the hard way, your clients start thinking you're nuts. So eventually you sort of have to get into language that, you know, yeah, makes sense for like the yeah actual thing. And, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, you turn off your internet connection and go to a web page in Chrome or whatever, and it says, you know, this web page failed to load or whatever. So it's like, you know, it's for better or for worse, it's very much still a part of the language of the web. It that doesn't necessarily mean that as makers, we need to, you know, buy into thinking of the page as like the printed page, essentially. Right. So that's a little bit there.
Yeah, I just and also I think it's something that just we will have to. I think it's just either a word that we have to. Word or vocabulary that we have to just, I think, deal with in such a ways. Because yeah, the thing that I bring up is like we saw the concept of above the fold.
Yeah.
Right. And that comes and goes in vogue, right? Like,
yeah,
it was like before, it was like, oh, it's terrible to have the concept of above the fold. Now it's like, oh, we need to have our CSS in line above the fold and, you know, yeah, for perceived performance. And like, oh, geez,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so, they're double-edged swords, I think. It's a, you know, on the way I sort of interpret the whole fold thing is whenever those conversations undoubtedly arise, it's more we try to unpack it as you're saying that this thing carries a lot of weight and should be prioritized over this other stuff. Yeah. And like whether or not that like officially means it needs to be in the viewport whenever the page loads, it's more about sort of hearing their desire to, you know, that this thing is actually really, really important. That's a real big goal for this screen.
Right. Yeah, definitely think so. Cool. Let's talk about your book. How did you write it? Open source? Was that out in the open when you how you wrote it?
Yeah, it's not open source, but basically what I did for the process of writing it is I basically shared the work as I was writing it. Nice. I knew that everyone that I've known, I think including you, like I can't remember if we chatted in too much detail, but it's like any author I know and I've talked to, you know, say that their projects have taken, you know, a year or two to, mm-hmm, you know, from soup to nuts, right? Beginning to end. It's like a 2-year process. And, yeah, you know, especially like if you, you know, if you're working with a company and stuff and you're dealing with like release schedules and all of that stuff. So, and I've been talking about atomic design, you know, for a while. So I'm like, man, I really don't want to like, you know, have been talking about it and then go away for a year and a half or 2 years and then suddenly come back and say, oh, by the way, you know, here you go. And I'd sort of come off of a project, that sort of unfortunately went south. Where, you know, we're working on sort of a web product sort of thing and it unfortunately sort of fizzled out and we didn't have anything to show for it. I was of the mentality, I like sharing a lot and sort of being open. And I think that it's a good business model to be open as possible and transparent and stuff like that. And the other people didn't see that way. And so whenever the thing went south, I lost a year of work essentially. So I'm like, okay, well, I definitely don't want to do that. So that's why I made the decision to write the whole thing in the open. I set it up so that people can pre-order the eventual ebook from day one of the project. And so that was pretty crazy just because, you know, from day one of me writing the first word of the book, I already had people committed to me finishing the project. So from an accountability standpoint, it was a tremendous motivator because it was like, I can't just go, this is too hard. Yeah. You know, never mind. I'm just going to back out of this. So it was, you know, whenever you have a bunch of people counting on you to finish it, it really puts that, you know, in the front of your mind all the time. So, so I'm really glad I did it that way though. So it was a bit like, it's like Kickstarter without Kickstarter, essentially. Right. I just sort of like set up a Shopify store and I just published it to a GitHub repo. And I use DeployBot, the sort of automatic sort of deployment service to sort of send it to my server. So every time I would commit, it would bounce over to my site. And so, and then as I would write, you know, some days I'd make better progress than others. And if I wrote a big sort of substantial chunk, I would, you know, share it, tweet it and whatever, the same way it's like writing a blog post or whatever. It's like, oh, hey, I wrote some stuff.
Did you find people, correcting or adding suggestions?
Oh my God. Yeah. It was awesome. It was this one morning I woke up and I had, this guy in Japan. So I woke up to just a flood of emails that were all of these like pull requests or whatever. And I'm like, here we go. Somebody's just being a jerk and, you know, is getting nitpicky. But then I actually went into each one. I'm like, yeah, he's right about that. Yeah, he's right about that. Oh, right, nice. About that. Right about that. Yep. That's a misspelling. Yep. That should be a new sentence. And so it was incredible just because, you know, one, I wasn't done with the book yet. Like I wasn't even close to being done with it. And to already have that sort of level of help was great. But then also just by sharing it, you know, I would share something and then people on Twitter would say, this makes a lot of sense, but you know, here's my apprehension about this, or, you know, oh, did you see this tool, or, oh, did you see this thing or this article that talks about this, you know, a similar concept. And so just it immediately just widened my perspective on the topic. And then I was able to, you know, roll that all back into the book. So I'm absolutely 100% pleased with how I went about writing it and publishing it and all of that. If I had to do it again, I would do it exactly the same way. Nice.
Cool. Yeah. That sounds an awesome way. Would it work?
Yeah. The hard thing about it was typically whenever people announce a book project, it's either available to order then, like, or in a week or something. It's like, oh, pre-orders start soon or whatever, and you'll get it in your mailbox, you know, 2 weeks from then. So it was pretty much like, especially as soon as people give you money, they're like, where's my thing? Yeah. Where's my thing? Get my thing done.
Yeah.
It's hard because like all of that stuff typically happens behind closed doors, you know, the whole authoring process, you know this better than anybody, you know, it's not easy to write these things and clear out your schedule and do all of that stuff and the editing and all the logistics that go into it. It's like typically that all happens behind the scenes. So it's really hard to manage people's expectations, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's also better, I think, is because I go away for like 6 months to a year or whatever. And then I come back like I have a book that no one knows about. And but now, like, you know, you open source it, you can tweet about it, and people give you feedback, and then that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it definitely helped. I want to write about it just because it sort of garnered interest in the project, you know, throughout the entire trajectory of the thing, so that by the time I actually said like, hey, it's done, it wasn't just coming at it from, you know, like I announcing it cold blindly or whatever. You know, it was, I had a lot of people that were anticipating it and whatever. And I think that helped certainly as far as the, you know, the response to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, how can people get a copy of the book?
Yay. it's at atomicdesign.bradfrost.com. And then the shop is shop.bradfrost.com, but it's all on the main atomicdesign.bradfrost.com. So you could either buy the book there, or I actually did leave up the entire text of the book online too. So that was sort of something I was going back and forth on. I'm like, oh, well, once I have this thing done, do I sort of pull it out, you know, and force people to buy the book? But I found it really helpful to, one, be able to sort of point people to, you know, so if somebody says, oh, I have a question about this, I could point them to an H2 in chapter 3 or whatever. You know, it's like, here's this section that addresses exactly that. So that's been a huge help for me, rather than going, well, first thing, you got to buy the book, then you got to get it shipped to you, then you got to open up to page 47. Right, so that's been really helpful. And then just by way of recognizing that not everyone's in a position to be able to purchase it. And that's right. Not really the main reason, you know, I wrote the book is to make a bunch of money. Like that's not it at all, is to share this information. So I'm happy I'm able to still have it be sort of financially successful, I guess, but also like still be able to share the information for nothing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that's great. I think it helps sell the book, like you mentioned there. But I think as someone who's a conference organizer who's seen you speak for several years now, I just loved having the book. I always felt like it was a polished Brad Frost presentation. Because I see this talk.
I appreciate that. Yeah,
I see it develop and grow, and I was just like, wow, this is, I remember him talking about this. Yes, I remember this. Yeah, this is great. This is awesome.
It was, and that was a big part of it. It was, you know, I've been talking about a lot of this stuff, and, you know, I've been thinking really hard about a lot of this stuff, and don't get me wrong. I absolutely love conference speaking. I love blogging. I love, you know, all these other sort of vehicles for communication, I guess. But to, yeah, have it all sort of be, you know, have it with a cover, and it's, you know, all nice and with a bow on it. Like I love having that, you know, to be like, this is a lot of what I care about, or this is like, you know, a lot of what I think about, sort of all wrapped up in one thing, is extremely satisfying. I'm sure as you know, as an author, it's like, here's a lot of thoughts on a thing, you know, in a digestible sort of format. It's great. Yeah,
exactly. And so, congrats on the book. I know it's tough work, and, do it. I also want to say thanks for the Ron Papule of Ronco name check in the book. I got a big kick out of the set and forget it.
Yeah.
I love that.
funny story. Yeah. So Ron Papil, set it, forget it, total, like, you know, telemarketer guy or TV like personality guy or whatever. And Owen Gregory copy edited the book, and he's based in the UK. and he's an absolutely lovely guy. And if you're writing a book, I highly recommend like hiring him, because he's just smart as anything. But yeah, he read that, and in the edits, he's like, this Ron Popeil reference, I don't know if that sort of made its way across the pond. And I'm like, no, it's staying in. It's like the one thing I was adamant about.
That was awesome. Yeah, I had a good laugh when I read that one. I had to go back and like, did I just read that? Okay. Yeah. That was great.
I'm glad. See? That's it. That just made it right there. That made it the decision justified right there.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And again, definitely What's the address for the book again?
Atomicdesign.bradfrost.com.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for having me. It was a great chat.
Okay. Awesome. Anytime, man.